What I was attempting to do is to try to determine whether or not we had a consensus on any of the bills that we just had public testimony on. We do, I know we have one more, Senate Bill 79. In my determinations, we don't have a clear consensus on the bills at this point in terms of our capacity to move them, although there is a substantial interest in moving them. I think what we want to do at this point is maybe we'll refer a work session on them and ask that the members of the folks that testified here today maybe meet with some of us individually and chat with us and make sure that we clear up some of the difficulties. I think on Senate Bill 78, my inclination is to not continue that simply because of the $4.5 million fiscal impact. And that's basically my determination at this point. Obviously, the committee can overrule me at some point if they want to hear that. So. We did have one other question. I think Senator Barr, you had a question with respect to the indigency of individuals, the appointment of an interpreter, and who pays. Is there ever a time when one of the parties to one of these cases would actually pay for an interpreter? Kingsley, whomever.
Senate Bill 69 was the question.
Senate Bill 69, I think, is the bill that's generating the question. And if you go to ORS 45275, subsection 2, it says that no fee shall be charged to any person, and it talks about the any person language. Then it goes on to talk about indigent persons will not have to pay. It doesn't seem to be very clear who the statute's talking about.
All right. For the record, Kingsley Slick, Chairman, is Senator Beyer. There is no payment required of people in proceedings where the interpretation is done for the court record, for the purposes of the court record. So when the court needs to be able to communicate with parties before it or put witness testimony on the official record, all the interpretation for that is state paid and is not attributed back to the parties. In an indigent defense, in a criminal case where the lawyer has an interpreter to communicate with his or her client, the court would not pay for that interpreter unless they were an indigent defense client. In other words, it was court-appointed counsel, then the state, as part of the court-appointed counsel expenses and representation, pays for the interpreter to communicate with the client. But if it was a retained case, retained attorney, then the person would be paying for that or however the attorney handled that billing, and the court would only be paying for that, what we call the proceeding interpreter. In a civil case, kind of similar thing, the court pays for the what we call the court interpreter for the official record. If the parties need to communicate in a civil case with their attorney or anyone else on something that isn't part of the record, we would not be paying for that. We, the state, would not be paying for an interpreter in that setting, and they would be on their own. There's some circumstances where the court, in order to get to the conclusion, provides an interpreter for the situation that a court would not ordinarily pay for, and then will allow it to be charged as part of the case costs at the end of it. So that's kind of an elaborate explanation, but the main one is not the statute language, I think, is confusing the way it's written, but what the state does pay for is anything that the court needs to conduct its business and put the record on the record, so to speak.
Mr. Chair, is there any way to mitigate some of that in cases where, I mean, I don't know, but if you've got people, even if they are the, I'm just trying to think in my mind or think out loud, some ways to lower the cost of some of these by charging court costs to more people if they're not indigent. I mean, to pay some of these court costs, even if the interpreter is needed for the, as you would you say, is for the to do the court record.
Chairman, Senator Beyer, there are, we can go back and do a little, maybe an explanatory paper that might say what, when they can charge and when they can't charge back. You have some flexibility there. It's just when you get into certain of the rights of parties and discriminating between who you're charging and who you're not, I mean, we certainly can't do it with American Disabilities Act. There's probably no situation right now that I can think of that we could recover court costs for sign language and interpreters against the person for whom it's being provided. In foreign language, we have a little more flexibility, but not real big windows. But in certainly civil litigation, we have a much larger window to do that.
Kingsley, help me understand this. At least if I'm understanding correctly, the state pays when it's establishing a record for its purposes, and I guess if I would put it in my own language, where the state is, in fact, the aggressor, so to speak. I mean, it's a dependency hearing or it's some kind of a proceeding other than civil where you've got two parties battling it out other than the state. But the state has a specific interest in a child custody situation, dependency, or some other matter that the state is initiating some action. Is that partially correct?
Chairman, that is partially correct. I mean, there are, even when they're both sides are private parties, like in a domestic relations, if the court is trying to conduct the proceeding and needs the parties to understand or to put testimony on the record, then the state is paying. But that is a circumstance where, for parts of that, they could recover costs if they felt there was an ability to pay back.
But it's a matter, of course, you don't. That's what you're saying in domestic relations cases.
Right. It if we already have an interpreter there for some other setting, if they're a staff interpreter or it's not a large part, then it's usually not an issue. In kind of our test is, would it be a CAFCA proceeding if the court didn't have an interpreter that is paying to conduct it or not, and meaning if to have any meaning for the other side or to make any sense of what was going on, you need an interpreter for the court to put things on the record and to conduct its business, then that's part of the court's cost.
Well, help me understand in terms of context, Kingsley, how often would this come up in a court, and is it, I guess, I'm assuming the establishment of indigency or the processing of paperwork and that kind of thing, there may be a cost. So in one hand, if you said, well, we're going to recover these costs where we can, but the audience is so small, the administrative costs outweigh the actual recovery, if that makes any sense. I don't know. Am I making any sense?
Chairman, yes, you are, and I understand what you're saying, and I don't have an answer for that, how often, and I can go back and talk to staff who processes those bills, and we can talk to some people in the courts and try and get a better sense of that for you.
Okay. Senator Beyer, then Senator Harper, and Senator...
I think she's answered my question that for the purpose of Senate Bill 69, that there would not be any ability to recover costs from anyone.
Is that what you said?
Chairman, Senator Beyer, that would be an interpretation of what I said. That would be correct. I did not expressly answer your direct question on 69, and in that setting, because of the rights that go with most of those proceedings, it would be one where there would be little chance that their civil recovery would be appropriate as a court cost.
I sense she's thinking kind of in the back of the mind, there may be some instance there you're trying to be extremely intellectually honest to us, and that I appreciate. Senator Harper.
You're much better off just telling Senator Meyer no. let me ask my question. It may not be feasible, but in the jury interpreters, to make this program more affordable, obviously Spanish interpreters would be in much greater demand than Swahili. Would it make sense to limit the number of languages that we would provide this for? Could you do that? Should you do that?
Senator Harper, it does self-select in a way, because if it requires a certified interpreter, Spanish is the largest. It's about 86% of the total cost that we're paying for interpreters right now. But if we were in Swahili, we do not have a certification program, and I'm not aware of any. We're part of a consortium of state courts, and I'm not aware of anyone else who's been able to certify Swahili. So that person would be excused.
No use Swahili, did you?
Okay. And Chairman, Senator Harper, part of, a big part of the fiscal, and we can go back and look at that, had to do with translation of forms. A lot of the costs that theoretically would be associated with this is if we are dealing with a situation where there's a large number of paper exhibits in things that would have to be translated into another language in order for the juror to understand the evidence or the exhibits, and that's where a large cost factor is, much more so than the straight, what I would call, oral interpretation.
And Senator Duncan, did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just had a comment over here that I recall incidents where I chaired a discipline committee of a pastor of a church situation, and that pastor spoke a foreign language and requested interpreters. And there was no doubt in my mind and everyone else's that he understood everything that was going on. He really didn't need an interpreter. But there was a real advantage in having an interpreter, because the time element, as questions were asked and then interpreted and so forth, it really gave him a great opportunity for answering questions. Because, you know, you could tell when you asked the question, he was on top of it right away, but he was waiting for the interpreter. And so the question I ask right now, and I don't know how you'd even deal with it, I wonder if there could be an abuse in people using it to their advantage. You know, I'm thinking if I were a trial lawyer, I might think, we'll do it this way, and that gives you more time to think through your answers and so forth. And I just raise that as a question. Has that been thought of at all, that people could abuse it when really they can handle English perfectly well?
Chairman, Senator Duncan, I think that possibility is always there, because I think it's there in probably any situation. The only way I would see it maybe coming up in this situation might be if a juror really wanted to be excused from service and was trying all sorts of ways, and this was their last resort, was to say they didn't understand, and the court said, so that...
I guess I wasn't thinking of the juror situation. I was thinking about maybe of a defendant in a case is what I was thinking that would require 50 lawyers.
Chairman Senator Duncan, yes, that's also a risk there.
Just something to live with, yeah.
Okay. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I interpreted your answer to Senator Harper's question, are you saying that, you said that most of the fiscal is for the cost of translating forms, et cetera, and that the only advantage of having, of limiting languages is you have the certified instructors. What I'm trying to get at is having a lot of languages as opposed to a few would not really change the cost of the translator, assuming you had certified translators. Is that correct?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, yes, because the predominant language would be Spanish.
Correct. They did have certified translators in French and Swahili and whatever else. It wouldn't cost that much for the translator per se. It's just that you would be opening yourself up to a larger group of people who could take advantage of it. Is that correct? I mean, there's nothing inherent in the addition of additional languages that would in itself raise the cost. It's just that it would increase the numbers who were able to use it. Is that correct?
Chairman and Senator Burdick, I mean, every little bit adds up. My knee-jerk, just based on looking at the what we pay for now in the courts and what percentage that represents of the payments of people coming before it, would suggest it would be more incidental and ancillary than, and the bulk of the cost would be because of Spanish speaking, and the Asian languages are the, and Russian are the second most used languages, and they are still, you know, about 3% of the ones that we're paying for, so it's not a large, it does add up, but it's not large compared to the Spanish speaking. Chair Minnis and Senator Harper, we'll look again at the fiscal, in the fiscals that we provide, we do lay out our assumptions, and this one is more difficult to, we have an understanding of how many people we're paying for in other situations, the number of defendants, the number of parties. We have less, we don't have any figures really for how much of the U.S. citizenry that's called the service are non-English speaking to have a better percent to use to apply to how many. We tried to, like I said, do a range and say if it's this percent, then that would translate into the average number of trials that are this many days, and this is our the hourly rate, and approximate it that way, and then make an approximation for forms that would go with that. So there may be other ways to look at it, but I don't think it entirely gets away that there would be at least there would be a substantial fiscal just to pay for the interpretation and translation. So it may not be what we've estimated.
Okay. Any other questions, comments, Judge, any? Okay. Then we'll close the public hearing on these bills and come back to them when we, since we have a consensus and the ability to move them out of the committee.
Chair Minnis, I would just like to indicate for the members that there is a progress report on Senate Bill 38 implementation relating to interpreters. This was presented to the Interim Judiciary Committee. The report's dated November 15th of 2000. Any members of the committee that are interested in receiving a copy of this report, if you'll let me know, I'll make some copies.
Okay. Increase your workload and reading. Okay, I want to move to the introduction of committee bills at this point. And Marilyn, we've got a bunch of drafts in front of us.
Are you going to have a hearing on this one?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to try to do this real quick.
Okay.
The chair's position on the introduction of committee bills, by the way, is pretty liberal. Pretty much introduce anything. That isn't a disclaimer.
No. That's always been my view of my vote on committee bills.
All right, and we should have a list of the LCs. We've got for introduction, I keep taking your stuff, don't I?
That's all right, you have one of your own.
I do.
We have the following bills for introduction by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Proposed amendment to the Oregon Constitution relating to impeachment of judges, LC 217. Relating to emergency medical services for children, LC 1497. Relating to driving under the influence of intoxicants, LC 1607. Relating to probation of youthful offenders sentenced as adults, LC 1978. Relating to evidence, LC 1979. Relating to discovery, LC 1980. Relating to privileged communications, LC 1981.
Mr. Chair, I move we introduce. Do you want it by number? As committee bills, legislative LC 1497, LC 1607, LC 217, LC 1978, LC 1979, LC 1980, and LC 91.
Okay. Senator Vern Duncan moves that we introduce for his committee bills. The LC's read for the record. Senator Courtney.
Nothing, Mr. Chair. I just, two of the bills are mine, and I won't, unless the chair wants me to comment on them, I will. Otherwise, just so the two of them are mine, and I'm prepared to talk.
May I reconsider?
You want to reconsider that?
Well, I assume that. I assume that the good senator from Milwaukee in that area was already making a comment on the quality of the bills when he took the list right out of my hands, since I was the vice chair, was supposed to make that motion, and he then proceeded to make the motion. So I assume that he was already commenting on the quality in his view of the content in those bills, which means he's an automatic no vote should he have those bills ever appear in front of him in any committee that he serves on.
I'm sorry, I didn't even know you were here.
Is there any objection to the motion? We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 79. Brad Swank.
It gets worse. Someone could be phoned in.
It gets worse.
Yesterday I carried the usual motion again, and I got it. It just goes on.
5 days or 2 months. Brad, whenever you're ready.
Chair members, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 79, which was introduced at the request of the Oregon Judicial Department. Senate 79 deals with alternate jurors in criminal cases. Alternate jurors are those jurors who are chosen, extra jurors who are selected at the beginning of a trial when it appears the trial may be particularly difficult or may last for a long time. They pick alternate jurors because people get sick, people die, people have medical emergencies, family emergencies, and if that happened to one of the jurors during a trial, after the trial had been going on or was half over, you've been in trial for a month and the juror gets sick or has a heart attack, then you may need an alternate juror to move in to fill that position rather than starting the trial over or having a mistrial or something like that, which could be expensive for everybody. And one of the standard concerns about alternate jurors is under the current statutory procedure, what happens is you select the regular panel of jurors and then you select the alternate jurors. Well, these people know that they're alternate jurors, and there is some concern that they may not pay as much attention during the trial because they may not feel that they have a real chance of doing deliberations. We had a judge, several judges actually, Judge Basinger from Linn County is one of the ones who brought this forward, who said what I would like to do is rather than designating who's an alternate juror at the beginning so they don't know, or so they know that they're alternate jurors, we'll just, if we're going to need 16, we'll pick 16, or we're going to need 14, we'll pick 14, and then after the case is presented, we'll select randomly which of the 12 are going to be the final 12 to go in for as those that deliberate, and the others would have paid full attention to the case to remove that concern. We did put a provision in the bill, and that's essentially what the bill does. It lets the judge just pick the number of jurors they're going to need up to 16 and not designate until the end who's going to be the alternate, and that would be done randomly. It does have a provision in, if you look on page 1 of the bill, lines 28 and 29, it's sort of an out provision because it says that a judge can designate earlier if the judge wants, and that's the current system. And we put that in there because there's some concern that any time that you go to a new system from an old system that some people think has worked, there may be situations that you hadn't thought of, and you don't want to keep the judges from going back to the old system that some people thought worked. So they could do that. It's just that the standard procedure would generally be to pick the larger number of jurors. And there is some experimentation that's going on under the current law with judges. I was just talking to Judge Leggett, and she said in a recent trial it was appropriate for them to keep from the jurors which ones were the alternate, but they let the parties know. So they designated for the sake of the parties at the beginning of the trial which were the alternates, but they didn't let the jurors know, so the jurors paid attention through the trial. And I think that kind of thing would be permissible if it were appropriate to the specific circumstance. Anyway, we're trying to create a situation that makes the jury work better when you have to use, in those circumstances, when you have to use alternates, because it encourages everybody to pay attention, but leaves substantial discretion with the judge to adjust for the circumstances that are appropriate. We put an emergency clause on it, and I know that this is a question that you frequently ask, because it's something that can be implemented easily and quickly by letting the judges know. It's not something that affects a lot of people, and it doesn't cost any money. When we select alternate jurors now, we pay for them. They're there. They have to sit there during the trial and listen, or they're supposed to sit there during the trial and listen like all the other jurors that are picked, because they may end up deliberating on the case. And some other jurisdictions have experimented with this, and we're looking at a lot of different things to make the jury system work better. Some of our judges came back from a conference in Arizona where they've been experimenting with this kind of thing and with other procedures relating to jurors to get jurors more involved and to make the jury system more effective. So Senate Bill 79 is the Judicial Department bill to at least take one step in this small area of using an alternate jurors in criminal trials and try and make it work a little better, but retain some flexibility. So I can answer any questions if you have them.
Senator Courtney and Senator Duncan.
Wait a minute. Take me through this, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You say after the case is presented.
Right. Yes.
Then you'll tell them who the real 12 are.
Chairman and Senator Courtney, the way that the bill is drafted, you select the number of jurors that you think you're going to need. Everybody
right.
listens.
16.
Say you take 16. And then the way the bill is drafted, you would randomly select the final 12 after the case is presented. So everybody would have an equal chance during the case.
Don't over-answer my question.
Okay.
I don't mean to cut you off or show disrespect to you. The question, counsel, is after the case is presented, what does the word presented mean? The evidence has been offered by both sides?
Chairman, Senator Courtney, yes.
All right. So now the judge turns to the jury and says, you chosen ones go into the room and come back with a verdict. Is that when you find out if you're going into the jury room or not?
No. Chairman, Senator Courtney, no, it's before the jury deliberates. After the case has been presented, before the jury deliberates.
All right. All right. That's just what I said. Before the jury deliberates. Okay, I got you. All right. So it's all over. It's time for the jury to go in the room, shut the door, and start Correct. Getting after it. Right?
Correct.
And that's when this group of 14 to 16 find out who the real group is that's going in the room.
Yes.
All right. Now, the alternates that don't know they're alternates, where is this whole group of people going to sit?
Chairman and Senator Courtney, currently in some courtrooms that have room, they sit up with the other jurors in the box. Sometimes where there is not appropriate room in the jury, they have to sit in the front row next to the bar. Some kind of accommodation has to be made.
Okay.
But
so
alternate jurors...
When the counsels are going to the jury to make their final statements... They got to be sure they speak to those in the jury box as well as those in the. They got to cover the whole world.
Senator Minnis, Senator Courtney, yes, that's a current issue. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hey, Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Swing, I'm just curious. Has anyone done an analysis in the state of how often? An alternate juror is used. I'm just curious to see.
Chairman, Senator Duncan.
Is it a common occurrence? I guess I should put
it is. It is not a common occurrence, to my understanding. It happens from time to time. We do have Judge Legerton in the audience, and she's used them from time to time if they're specific questions. But I don't think it's a particularly common practice. And I don't know of any studies that have done
it. I was just curious if it really was a... I'm not opposed to the bill. I'm just was curious if it's a major problem.
Actually,
around this
the last murder trial I was engaged in, we lost two jurors at the break.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't hear the judge say, come back at 1... They came back at 1:30, and the judge started the trial. And they were bumped off, and they were not happy about that. I weren't happy at all. I don't know how often that happens because...
I was just curious. Was it
second degree?
I don't think this relates specifically to this bill, but when there is an alternate juror and they need a new juror in the course, say somebody gets sick in the course of a lengthy deliberation, then can alternate jurors go in and resume deliberating, or is that the end? Is that a mistrial?
Sure. Chairman, Senator Burdick, my understanding is that the process is judges have the discretion to dismiss the alternate jurors when the deliberations begin, but one of the reasons for having them during trial is that they can be held during deliberations, not in the jury room, but separately, and can be asked to come in because they've then heard the entire trial. They may have to be brought up to speed by the jury on the deliberations. I know in Arizona I did hear a judge who talked about letting alternate jurors sit in on the deliberations, not participate. There were some questions about that, but they are trying that in some other jurisdictions. But alternate jurors can be held. You may remember the O.J. Simpson trial where, well, actually that went fairly quickly, didn't it? But some, in the second trial, there were some alternate jurors.
Probably not a good example.
Probably not a good example. I apologize for even mentioning these cases. Just forget I said it.
Okay. Senator Metzger. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This reminds me of an English teacher I had. I mean, it had this, used the same technique where we, you know, we would read three books and we're going to be tested on one of them. She wasn't going to tell to make sure that we stay attentive. I was just curious on this on line 24 where it says, after all, we do all this, the court shall direct the random selection of 12 jurors to deliberate. And I was wondering, is there a standard procedure for this? I know, like in our family for Christmas now, we put the presents in the floor and we put our names on a piece of paper and we go grab number one, two, or three, and that's how we randomly get gifts. Is there a standard procedure here for a judge? What would be the random, and is there any need to specify how a random selection would take place?
Chairman and Senator Metzger, it is not a procedure currently used in courts because the statute provides otherwise. The random selections, it's not something I think that needs to be specified in the statute. I don't think judges, I mean, will have, they could draw straws. There are a number of things they could do. I think it reaches a level of specificity that the statute probably doesn't need to address, as long as it's random.
Well, what would be the likely, you mentioned drawing straws, would that be a likely thing the judge would do, or how do you do that in this level?
Chair Menace, Senator Metzger, more likely, I assume that there'll be, I mean, we're working on different ways of doing random things. There might be a computer program where the names are randomly kicked out of the computer of the however many you selected. That wouldn't be something that would be difficult to put together in terms of a small computer program that has a random selection feature on it if you've got 12 names. Mm-hmm. I don't think technologically it's a difficult issue.
Yeah. Just curious why they...
Hey, Senator Harper? Or Ms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me get back to Senator Courtney's question, if I understand it. You got 12 jurors in some courtrooms that are in the jury box, and you've got a couple of more, you know, that may wind up being the prime people. Does that give us a due process problem or an appeal issue or anything like that, in your opinion? Would that?
Chairman and Senator Harper, we currently use alternate jurors. Alternate jurors is a current thing that happens in criminal cases, and it's happened for a number of years where you may have 14 to 16 jurors, and not all courtrooms are equipped for it, and it is an accepted procedure. All this bill does is change when you tell them they're alternates and the process for doing that.
Okay, so the current system has been in place for
a number of years.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that did raise a question in my mind, though, but currently when the prosecuting attorney or the defense attorney is talking to the jury box, they know that is their 12 jurors. And if a juror has to be dismissed, then that person is now again sitting in the juror box. And here what you're describing is a situation where you've got 12 here and two back there or four back there someplace. And as much as learned counsel and high, you know, Senator Courtney said, you've got to be, you're now a tag team, so to speak.
Chair.
And so there is a difference in what, because currently you know those 12 are the ones you're talking to.
Chair Menace, Senator Byers, I mean, that is a current issue. I mean, not all courtrooms are currently designed to hold 14 jurors or 16 jurors in the jury box, and some accommodation currently has to be made when alternate jurors are used because not all of them may be able to fit in the jury box. So it may be in a current trial.
Chair, I think you haven't got my point, is that may be true. There are four people behind me that may at some point in time become the juror. When that happens, now they're in front of me again. So you know the jurors who are going into that jury room currently are the ones that are right here. You don't care about those guys back there because odds are they're never going to get in that jury room anyway.
Sure.
But when they do, then they're up here. They displace someone.
Chairman Menace, Senator Byers, that's true. But one of the points that Judge Basinger, for instance, raised when we chatted about this earlier is that if you're not paying attention to those alternates currently who are sitting in the back of the room, you increase the chance that when they go in, if they do have to become one of the jurors who deliberates, that the jury proceedings in the room may not work as well because they may not have been paying as close attention. That's the concern, that in fact some attorneys may not be addressing the alternates, and there's a real possibility that may make it hard if one of them has to be called in to actually serve. They may not have the same perspective of the case as the jurors who are being addressed all of the time. And the purpose of the bill is to say that, you know, if you don't know, then yeah, probably you got to make sure that your four alternates or your two alternates are getting the same attention, because if something happens and they have to go into the jury room, you want that transition to be smooth, and you want them to have paid the same attention as the jurors who you thought were the important ones. I mean, that's the purpose.
Senator Burdick.
No, it's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I'm disturbed by that too, because if you just look at the odds, if you look under the current system and you have 16 jurors, a pool of 16 jurors, and you have 12 in the box and 4 in the front row, then the odds are that only one of those in the front row would ever be in play in the jury room. But under this, if you had that same scenario, then you could have a full one-third of your jury sitting in that less desirable location. In other words, you could have the, you know, obviously they're oriented more toward the jury box. And, you know, I've seen some of these trials, and they can get very, very intense, you know, especially opening statements, closing statements. And I think some lawyers would be more skilled than others at being able to be inclusive. But, you know, if you were one of those lawyers who was not as skilled at being inclusive, and then you ended up with all four of those in the front row actually serving on your jury, and you've been addressing yourself to, you know, four people who won't be in that room, then is justice really served fairly for your client, especially if your opponent maybe is very skilled at that?
Chairman Ennis, Senator Burdick, I think that's a legitimate issue, and I won't argue with that. We have a judge who came to us and said that he had been, and we have other judges who are interested and said that they had seen demonstrations and heard presentations by judges from other places that use this system, who say that the system works better, it improves juror response, it makes the alternate jurors feel like they've done their duty, and it produces a better result in terms of the jury. We did put in the provision, and some people will argue, as you did, that maybe it's not appropriate, which is why we put the provision in down, allowing the court the discretion to do it the way they currently do it. I mean, everybody's not going to be happy with the new system, but we have judges who want to try this, who believe that it will improve the jury system, and we sort of felt obligated to bring it forth, because I've heard the presentations from other states too, and the judges from Arizona at least rant and rave about this working a lot better. So if a judge wants to try it and it's not currently allowed by statute, at least there needs to be a statutory change if people are going to experiment in the area and see how it works.
If I could follow up, one solution might be, and I don't know if this is necessary, whether the judges would come to this on their own or whether we'd run into an unfunded mandate problem here, but maybe we might want to consider specifying in the bill that in cases where all the jurors can be in the same, you know, general situation during the trial, that this could apply. Because I like the idea, too. I mean, I know I've been on several jury pools. I never seem to quite make the cut. But I can certainly see where this would get people more engaged. I'm not going to tell you why I won't make the cut either.
Mr. Chairman Ennis and Senator Burke, I actually don't know how many courtrooms there are in Oregon that are even 14-person accessible for that many jurors. I know that in Arizona, because I was down there, which is where I heard about it, they're starting to build their new jury rooms with 14 people. I know in Oregon, some of the judges course, sitting in what used to be district court courtrooms, had jury boxes that were only designed for six people. So, I mean, we've got, that is an issue in courtrooms and courtroom facilities now, even for 12-person jurors. Sometimes accommodations have to be made. So I don't know how that would affect this bill if we put a limitation on and said that, you know, you could only use this system if you're in a facility that was 14-person or something like that.
Senator Duncan and...
Mr. Chair, I guess we're not really debating the bill. The only thing I would say is it sounds like the courts and the judges want to give this a try, and so really this is enabling legislation for them to do it. And I'd hate to see us get into the business of micromanaging how they set up their courtroom or anything like that. I just think it's...
We do have one person signed up to speak in opposition to this.
I'd love to hear it.
We have a very limited amount of time. Dale, do you feel like you can share your points of view? And then we'll probably bring this thing back on Monday if need arises. And not to cut you off, Mr. Swank, but, you know, 5 minutes for the opposition, 25 minutes for the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney. I'm representing the District Attorneys Association. Judge Legert wanted me to respond to Senator Burdick's question. There is a statute that says if you do use alternate jurors, you must have them seated in a manner as close as possible to all the other jurors. And the courts try to deal with that. And if you have a district courtroom with six chairs, I know there's been attempts to remodel those, but they might move it to another courtroom where there's 12 chairs and that type of thing. So, and they may set chairs next to the jury box, but I haven't seen it done where you have someone sitting out in the audience. They'll have them as close as possible. Our concern here is that this process is used only in big cases for the large part. There might be some one-day or two-day cases where occasionally you'll have alternates, but this really comes up in murder cases, 2-3 week cases, 2-month cases, because that's when you run the risk that someone's going to get sick, someone is going to have a problem, not going to be able to finish this trial. So these are very important cases, generally, when you're going to have alternates. We are very concerned about this process. I've picked alternates before, and you have a whole process for examining a jury, and then all your peremptory challenges go away, and you pick under this statute. I have one challenge for two alternates. If I'm a criminal defense lawyer, if the five people sitting in the courtroom to be examined for those two chairs are ex-state police officers, I'm going to be real concerned, and I've got one challenge. In my scenario, if I have five people back there that perhaps for whatever reason, it's a narcotics case, and they don't think narcotics should be illegal, I've got a big problem. Picking alternates has always been a dicey issue for trial lawyers. I will simply say that from my own personal experience. I wouldn't have a problem with this if it was interesting to me that the bottom line is the exception on lines 28 and 29, the trial judge can decide not to do this whenever they want. So it's their choice. If we put in there that the trial judge or the parties may object so that you do this when all the litigants believe this is appropriate, I really wouldn't have a problem with this. But the way it is now, I have no say whatsoever, and I can be real concerned, particularly in a murder case where it needs to be unanimous. That's the issue. So at any rate, that's my thoughts real quickly, and maybe that's a way to deal with it.
Hey, Senator Courtney.
Well, just due respect, Senator Duncan, the point I was going to make, and of course the District Attorney of Marion County has now made it, you say if the judges want to do this, I want to know where the criminal defense bar is, I want to know where the DAs are. The courtroom is designed not just for the benefit of a judge. It's designed to allow a jury, the prosecution, the criminal defense attorneys, all the players, to have an opportunity to make this system work. And at this stage of the game, I'm uneasy here. One of the things about a jury box, there's a statement by a jury box that you're separating a jury from the general public that comes into the courtroom. Now, just that alone, psychologically, is an important factor. And what you do with these alternates, even though if you try to get them as close to the jury box, their proximity to people sitting behind them, maybe making remarks they can pick up on things. And to me, the jury box is very sacred. It's a sacred thing. And I wish in this bill there was something to make sure these alternates are in the jury box in some way. On the other hand, if you can't do that, I like what the district attorney is saying. All parties should have the options to say yay or nay. I mean, I don't know where the criminal defense bar is in this. I notice they're not signed up. I'd really be curious to know how they would react to this, because Dale's right. When you get into alternates, it is a dicey, dicey situation. And by the way, you mess up here, you're going up on appeal, and you're playing, just so you know, you're asking for all kinds of troubles and appeals. So I'm not trying to get in the way of Arizona, since they keep coming up, the Wildcats. But I just don't make me vote on this right today, please. I need help. I need emotional and psychological and legal help before I get there on this bill. I may be there, but I just need help right now. Something's wrong with me right now. I'm missing something.
We're at the time at which we're supposed to close, so go ahead and adjourn. And I just want to say before we do that, the one concern I had is the randomness issue, and I'm not sure how it's done now, but I got this vision of one of those little balls blowing around with numbers on it, somebody appealing because it wasn't done as randomly as they thought it should have been done. So
it's a recycling. It's a paper.